a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. I'd like to call to order the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. I'd like to welcome our internet listeners this morning, and I'd like to welcome all of you in attendance. Just a reminder to please turn off your cell phones, and I will ask the secretary to call the roll.
Bradford.
Here.
Holeen.
Here.
Krebs. Rampelberg. Schleckaway.
Here.
Krause.
Here.
Hunhoff.
Here. Thank you. We have a quorum present. I would entertain a motion to move the minutes from the last meeting.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Senator Krause, second by Senator Holeen. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Well, again, good morning to all of you. We have a full agenda, and certainly my privilege this morning to welcome the First Lady of South Dakota and the Secretary of Health, who is this morning are going to provide us with an overview of the task force that was carried out this summer on infant mortality. So, again, I'd like to welcome First Lady Linda Dugard, and we are looking forward to your presentation.
Well, thank you.
First of all. Madam Chair and members of the Health Committee, my name is Linda Dugard, and I got the privilege of chairing the 2011 Infant Mortality Task Force. Thank you for allowing me to be here today to share what we learned and the recommendations that we gave to the governor. And that for those listening on the internet, a copy of my presentation can be followed on the Department of Health website. It's under Department of Health, Infant Mortality homepage, presentation to the Health and Human Services Committee. And in the State of the State message in January 2011, the governor talked about infant mortality in South Dakota. And he said that the rates were getting higher than they should be, and he said in 2011 he would convene a task force to address that. And the purpose of the task force on page 2 is to study infant mortality and recommend strategies to improve birth outcomes and infant health in South Dakota. And infant mortality is the golden measure for each state. The Wikipedia definition, which is now up and not black anymore, defines infant mortality as the number of infant deaths 1 year or younger per 1,000 live births. On page 3, I talk about the task force that was created. In May 2011, the governor signed an executive order to convene a task force. And with the help of the Secretary of Department of Health, Deneen, a diverse group from rural and urban areas of the state was gathered. Quite a diverse group. We had family physicians, OBGYNs, pediatricians, neonatologists, perinatologists, forensic pathologists, nurses, certified nurse midwives, certified nurse practitioners, hospitals, rural clinics, social workers, the School of Medicine, Aberdeen Area Indian Health Service, Great Plains Tribal Epidemiology Center, and state agencies. And I learned how to name all those natologists. We met 3 times throughout the summer and fall. We met in June, September, and in November in 3 locations across the state. We met in Sioux Falls initially. Rapid City was our second meeting. And then we ended our meetings in Pierre. At every meeting, there was an opportunity for public testimony and input. And after our first meeting, we had 3 subcommittees that met via conference calls. And they were on prenatal care, alcohol and tobacco use, and SIDS. On page 4, we'll give you a brief synopsis of the statistics. And Lon Keitlinger, our epidemiologist, is the one that helped with this data. Since 2000, 877 South Dakota infants died before their first birthday, an average of 80 babies a year. Over the past 50 years, the South Dakota infant mortality rate has decreased dramatically until 2000, when it started to slowly increase. For 2000 to 2010, South Dakota's infant mortality rate was 7.0 per 1,000 live births, higher than the neighboring states. And if you look at the map right next to it, our neighboring state of North Dakota is 5.9, Minnesota is 5.0, Iowa 5.2, Nebraska 5.9, and Montana 6.0. with South Dakota being 7.3. South Dakota has the 29th highest infant mortality rate in the United States, being slightly above the national average of 6.8. And the second map is of South Dakota, and it goes county by county what their infant mortality rate is. Beneath the map of the United States, then, is infant mortality by race in South Dakota for the past 10 years from 2000 to 2010. And the blue line signifies the South Dakota white population. The orange line is South Dakota American Indian population. And the black line is an average of South Dakota overall. Pretty telling picture. So if we go to page 5, the American Indian infant mortality rate is twice as high as the white infant mortality rate in South Dakota, and it's the highest American Indian rate of any state in South Dakota, in the United States. South Dakota ranks 21st in the United States for its neonatal mortality rate. And if you want to just jot down what these terms are. Morning, Chantel. Neonatal is birth to 27 days. I have to have a cheat sheet every time we talk about these titles. So neonatal is birth to 27 days. Post-neonatal is 28 days to 1 year. And when we talk about infant mortality, that's from 0 to 1 year old. Good morning. So the second point, South Dakota, we're on page 5. The second point is South Dakota ranks 21st in the United States for its neonatal mortality rate. That's birth to 27 days, 4.3 per 1,000 live births. But it's 40th for its post-neonatal, which is the 28 days to 1 year. And that's 3.0 per 1,000 live births. American Indians accounted for 18% of all births, but 32% of all infant deaths. Lastly, the American Indian infant dies at approximately twice the rate of the white infants and triple the rate of white infants during the post-neonatal period, which is the 28 days to 1 year old. And the graph down below breaks that out. The next thing we looked at was smoking. Smoking associated with neonatal, post-neonatal, and infant mortality rates. So over the past 5 years, Over the past 5 years, 68.5% of South Dakota mothers received early prenatal care. That's in the first trimester of pregnancy. And I thought this was very telling. The infant mortality rate of mothers who started prenatal care during the first trimester was 5.8. But 7.8 for those starting during the second trimester, and 9.0 for those starting the third trimester, and 46.4 for those with no prenatal care at all. So, of course, prenatal care needed to be addressed. South Dakota has one of the highest rates of mothers smoking during pregnancy, and we were astounded at that also. Over the past 5 years, 18.5% of mothers smoked while they were pregnant. The infant mortality rate for infants of mothers who smoke was 10.5 versus the 6.2 for infants of non-smoking moms. Then on page 6, after we looked at all the data, then we put our goals together. And this is also in the Department of Health 2020 plan. Our first goal was to reduce the infant mortality rate to 6.0 per 1,000 live births by 2015.
Thank you.
Second, to reduce neonatal mortality rate, and that's the birth to 27 days, rate to 4.1 per 1,000 live births by 2015. And it was currently at 4.3. The third thing was to reduce post-neonatal mortality rate, and that's the 28 days to 1 year, to 2.0 per 1,000 live births by 2015. The next one, to increase the percent of women who receive first trimester prenatal care to 78% by 2015, and that was before at 68.5. And then finally, to reduce the percent of women who smoke during pregnancy to 15% at least by 2015. As we looked at the problems and recommendations, we had four overarching themes that continued to come up. And the first one is we needed to work in partnership. We needed doctors, social workers, nurses, OBs, all to work together, and hospitals. The second thing, we need to recognize cultural diversity. We don't all do things the same way. Used evidence-based interventions, things that we could record. And the last, to reduce health disparities. So all these are woven into our recommendations. So we came up with six recommendations that we gave to the governor. And that was on December 15. And the first one was to improve access to early comprehensive prenatal care. And you saw from the statistics what a big difference that makes when they get that early prenatal care. The second thing was to promote awareness and implementation of safe sleep practices. And I'll talk later about that via the crib over here we set up. The third thing is develop community-based systems of support for mothers and families. And we found that the moms that had a support system before birth and after were more successful. The fourth recommendation, to conduct statewide education campaigns to reduce infant mortality. The fifth, to develop resources for health professionals specific to infant mortality prevention. And the last one, to improve data collection and analysis. So when we went to the governor, if you go to page 9, and I'd only given him tidbits of what we were doing. So it was a little bit of a surprise, but no, after every meeting, I come home and say, honey, did you know? And a half hour later. So as a task force, we put together four key areas that we know we can do now. And the first one was access to prenatal care. And let me tell you, the committee members were so dedicated to this committee and to accomplishing something. I was just amazed at the education that we had on this task force and the commitment from every one of them. And there was no one that left the room that didn't say, this is what I'm going to do, or this is what I'm going to do. And as a group, I know we can make a difference. So the first one, access to prenatal care. pilot centering programs in 2 to 3 rural sites in South Dakota. And I knew nothing about centering before this task force. And what that is prenatal care visits provided as a part of a group of pregnant moms, 8 to 12 pregnant moms. And the sessions include individual assessment by the medical provider, which most visits do, and then formal group discussions on such topics such as exercise, nutrition, infant feeding, birth preparation, recovery, comfort, and stress reduction, baby care and safety, and infant development and parenting. And these are usually about a 2-hour visit. And Dr. Lori Landine from Sanford was the initial person that gave us the instruction in centering. And then since then, Dr. McKay from Avera was also trained after the second task force meeting. And the second part of access to prenatal care is explore options to assist with transportation. That seemed to be a big obstacle, especially in the rural areas, that someone would take the car in the morning and the mom wasn't able to get to a visit in the afternoon. The next thing, reduce smoking among pregnant moms. And from the statistics, we knew we had to address that. So provide tools and training to assist health care providers to address tobacco use with their pregnant patients and refer them to the South Dakota Quitline, the sdquitline.com. And I gave you 2 handouts. And the first one is the white brochure that I left with all of you. And we have extras for the audience as well. If you have one thing to put in your pocket that would save thousands of lives, what would it be? And that is first for doctors to ask, do you smoke? You know, and whether you're going in for an OB visit or for your yearly check or whatever, do you smoke? And then advise if they do, and then refer them to the South Dakota Quitline. And all the information is right here. And the Department of Health has already published these and will be giving these to all docs. So this is a great tool. And then the second brochure that they've also published with tobacco money is What Would You Do to Save Your Child's Life? And it's the dangers of smoking before and after childbirth. And remember the statistics in there, the number of moms that smoked while they were pregnant. And then afterwards, too. I think they thought, oh, if I don't smoke and then have my baby, then I'm good to go after I have it. But remember that baby's still in the home among all that smoke. So this is a great brochure that addresses the dangers of smoking before and after childbirth. And again, it has the South Dakota Quitline on it. In the January 2012 South Dakota Medicine Journal for the State Medical Association, they published in the center of their magazine what doctors should ask. And we are so glad this came out. And it says the same things. You need to be asking every patient, do you smoke? Tell them about, ask them, advise them, and then refer them to the Quitline. Then I also noticed in this free publication, and I don't know if anyone has seen this on the task force, it's called the 605 magazine. That's free at gas stations, coffee shops, restaurants, and it's put out in Sioux Falls, but right inside the front cover is a great illustration. It says, when you smoke, so does your baby. And I don't know if you've seen this commercial on TV, but my 87-year-old mom called up and she said, have you seen the commercial about the baby and the smoking? So she proceeded to go to everyone that was pregnant in the nursing home where she is to remind them what happens to that baby if they're around smoke or if they're smoking. So so we know smoking. Then another thing, the public messaging on harmful effects of smoking while we're pregnant. I received papers from 12 USD students. Their instructor at the Beacom School of Medicine, Jen Porter, said, look what the state is doing. They're looking into infant mortality. I want you to go on the Department of Health's website. I want you to read what they've done, and I want you to write your recommendations. So 12 students at USD then sent me, averaged about 5 pages of recommendations on what we should do for infant mortality to message their age group. And that was very interesting. And you know what it is. It's all social media, texting. It's got to be there. So that was very interesting from that. Then also, I went a little bit younger to the Brookings Boys and Girls Club and met with a focus group there. And they were 12-year-olds to about 17-year-olds. And I said, if I wanted to tell you not to smoke, you hear it from mom and dad and everybody else, but how would you like to hear it? And they said, well, you could send us a text. You know, we'll read it. You could maybe advertise on a web page, but, you know, there's a lot of ads and they go away in 10 seconds. But they said, you know, if we hear it from a trusted teacher, from a good teacher in a health class or one of our friends, then we'll think about it. So that was interesting. And the one boy said, you know what? Do you know that a Buffalo Wild Wings is opening in Brookings? I said, well, how'd you find that out? And he said, oh, I got a text earlier today. They haven't started advertising yet, but I got a text. So, you know, we need to address that age of children. And they're also working within the Boys and Girls Clubs with a smoking message that, you know, it's just not cool. So anyway, that was interesting, too. The third thing is safe sleep practices. And if I had to pick one thing out from this whole task force, it would be safe sleep. And, you know, if you would have told me that from our first initial meeting, I would have said, no, there's much more important things than that. But I think safe sleep is number one. Establish a Cribs for Kids program to distribute cribs to low-income families who need a safe sleep environment for the baby. The set would include a play-in pack, a crib sheet, a crib, the halo sack, and a pacifier. That is all that should be in a crib. And that's why we brought a crib today. This is an example of a Cribs for, I don't know if you can see it over there, Senator, but a Graco crib pack and play. Is that what you have?
Over the last 11 months, I've learned that term.
And I bet you know how to put it together and take it apart. Exactly. And so what we are recommending, thank you, Mr. Keitlinger. You do a very good job at that. Yes. Yeah. What they recommend is just the crib with a crib sheet, the baby in a sleeper, a lightweight sleeper for summer or a heavier sleeper for wintertime, and a pacifier, and that's it. And I was one of those moms that had the bumper pads in and the stuffed animals and the blankets over the top, just thinking that that was what the baby needed, and that is not what the baby needs. That's all they need. I was lucky to meet with, I talked to the First Lady of North Dakota and said, that Dennis was going to come up for an oil and gas meeting. Could she and I meet? And I was working on an infant mortality task force. So she arranged for the director of the Division of Family Health and I to get together. And it was a woman by the name of Kim Mertz. And she said North Dakota's big push right now was the Cribs for Kids. And she told us about that program. And then she also came down and presented at our Rapid City meeting. She brought her family down and stayed all day long and presented at our committee meeting and then spent the weekend in the Black Hills. But their main focus up in North Dakota then is the safe sleep and the Cribs for Kids. And then a second part of the safe sleep practices is a statewide education campaign to increase the awareness of safe sleep practices. And it's interesting. I've only talked to one group so far, but a husband and wife came up to me afterwards and they said, you know what, Linda, our daughter lives next door to a first-time mom and dad, and the baby passed away over the weekend. And they were just heartbroken. And so they've had a lot of dialogue about safe sleep. And she said, so, of course, when our kids came home with their new baby, they said, get all the stuff out of the bed, Mom. You know, it's got to be just the crib and just their sleep sack and a pacifier in there. So the last thing is to reduce the disparities. and expand the Bright Start Nursing Program, and the governor talked about this in his 2012 State of the State speech. Expand that to four more communities and start with Pine Ridge and the Sisseton area. And it's an evidence-based program offering nurse home visits to high-risk families during pregnancy, after delivery, and continuing until the child's second birthday. And that was a program that started in June of 2000 in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. And the second part of that is culturally appropriate public and provider education messages with specific focus on American Indian population. One of the neonatologists said, you know what, this would be a great topic for our grand rounds, which the docs make, I think they make weekly, don't they? They bring up a certain situation and discuss that. So he said that's what he was going to do in his grand rounds. The next page is just a picture of what I described before with the safe sleep concept. And it shows the crib and the baby in their sleep sack and the crib sheet. And on the crib sheet, it says, keep me safe. Now I lay me down to sleep alone in my crib without a peep. On my back in smoke-free air. Thank you for showing me that you care. And that's Safe Cribs concept. So then, of course, to end it all out, we needed a call to action. And we know that it's going to take a lot of different groups to do this. Parents and family is one place to start. Our healthcare providers are definitely going to have to help us out with this one. Hospitals and health systems are in. Tribal health. Communities. Professional organizations, state government, and task force members. And we all committed to come back to Pier 12-12-12 to have a follow-up meeting on what we've done this year and what we need to continue to do. One interesting email that I just received yesterday, Gail Gray, and I'm sure she's presented before this committee a couple times before she was retired, but she sent me an email, and she said, Linda, I'm out in Rapid City, and she said, I want you to present before the Rotary Club in Rapid City next week about infant mortality. And she said, by the way, I just got money from the foundation out there to start our safe sleep program, our Cribs for Kids. Good for you, Gail. And we have a lot of people out there that are jumping on the bandwagon. I've also talked to the South Dakota Medical Association Auxiliary. They said, tell us what you want us to do, and we'll help you out on this. So it's definitely been a big effort by a lot of people. And the last page just shows where the final report can be found. And I also have copies of the final report if you would like a paper copy. I'll have the pages ask if you'd want a paper copy. And that goes into more detail. I just kind of gave you a brief synopsis of everything, but that was the final report that we gave to the governor if you'd like a paper copy. So in conclusion, it was truly an honor to chair this task force. And with some of our state's finest medical experts, tribal health representatives, hospitals, providers, and state agencies. And I'm confident that our recommendations will reduce infant mortality in South Dakota. So if you have any questions, I don't know if I can answer them, but we'll try.
Thank you, Linda.
You're welcome.
This is excellent, and as someone that has some exposures to some of these scenarios that are pointed out, I think the exciting piece is the collaboration that your work group has provided, as well as definitive recommendations and practical ones that certainly can be implemented everywhere in a joint effort. So with that, are there committee members that have questions? Senator Bradford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, I'm extremely interested in this, and I wonder, did they have any detail as to what actually in the infancy, in the time of the first trimester, when these deaths are, and they're making them, according to this, they're tobacco related. What is it in the tobacco that's maybe killing this child?
Madam Chair, I don't have the medical background for that, Mr. Bradford, but we could get back to you on that, Senator, unless anyone else has.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Why I'm saying that is that I happen to be old enough to know that during the war, when the baby boom was on, and my brothers and my sister were all, smoking was much more prevalent at that time. We didn't have very many early deaths. Of course, somehow the birth was more of a family deal too. I mean, no, everybody in our community, at least, knew who was going to have a baby, and everybody was watching out and all that. But I do know that the smoking, and not only that, they had no filtered cigarettes. They were all, you were sucking in the whole shebang. And I'd just like to know if it's more a side effect that smoking mother may be neglecting something more than it's the actual smoke. That's what I'm wondering. I really, really do appreciate what you've done. I mean, it's a really big thing, you know, on our reservations. Then the other thing I wondered is, were the counts, like I see Pennington County, were the native separated in that too, on the death, Mom?
It was. I'll refer that, Madam Chair, I'll refer that to Secretary Hollinsworth.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Donnie Hollingsworth, and I'm the Secretary of Health. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Donnie Hollingsworth, and I'm the Secretary of the Department of Health. I'll try to answer a couple of your questions, Senator Bradford. First of all, regarding the 40s, and it didn't seem like so many babies were dying. Actually, hundreds of babies died a year. In 1960, there were 500 infant deaths. And now it's about 80 a year. So the mortality rate was much, much higher in the 40s and the 50s. And it just kept, it's continued to decrease significantly. As far as the Pennington County rate, that would be the total rate in Pennington County. We could break that out by race, but we don't have that with us. We could get back to you with that. But the rate that's on that map is total infant mortality for the county for, I think it's a three-year period.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator?
Well, I realized that you'd say that the deaths were high then, but I don't believe at that time they were related to tobacco smoke. I believe they were more related to we had no doctors. There was no doctor at all in Parmalee, that all the births were by somebody else. So, I mean, I don't think it's a fair comparison. Maybe in the 60s you could, but not back in the 40s.
Madam Chair, great point, Senator Bradford. Of course, lots of public health things have improved the birth rate.
To answer my question, really, is there has to be some relationship to either the nicotine, if it's attributed to smoking, there has to be something in that cigarette that's deterring the health of that child.
Certainly there is. And that's what I can't describe for you what it is, but definitely studies show that secondhand smoke has an impact on the birth weight of the child. And also our data in South Dakota and nationally show that mothers who smoke have a higher rate, or their babies have a higher rate of infant mortality.
Madam Secretary, there is a physician here that is raising her hand, and she'd like to address. She is someone from my community and specializes with breast cancer, and she's also very active in the American Cancer Society. So if you want to come up front, and please identify yourself for the home audience.
I didn't know if it was appropriate from the back row to burst in, but anyway, my name is Dr. Mary Milroy. I'm actually a general surgeon. I am not a pediatrician. I'm not an obstetrician, but I am a general surgeon. And I will say that when I talk to my patients, I always counsel them against smoking. And I can tell you what happens with smoking and what I, in a way, infer is happening during the first trimester is smoking has a profound effect on the circulation through the body, especially the small blood vessels. And I know that there is vasoconstriction and impaired blood flow. And as a general surgeon, I know that people do not have good wound healing when they smoke. I tell all people not to smoke. If we have wound infections or we're doing procedures that involve flaps, cell death, tissue death occurs in smokers in a way it does not occur in non-smokers. And so I think what happens is in pregnancy, what is occurring? There's a tiny fetus that's trying to implant. It's trying to grow. It needs, of course, blood supply and nutrition. There is a placenta that is trying to attach to the uterine wall to provide this essential nutrition to a growing fetus. And I know for a fact that that process of providing the essential blood supply to that infant is impaired in a smoker. I think that there have been documented evidence that there are small placental infarcts and impaired vascularity in the placenta, which causes early fetal loss and impaired growth. The babies, when they are growing, we didn't even address small birth weight infants, and that is definitely higher in women who smoke. And so those are many of the children that end up going into the neonatal intensive care units as very small weight, which we know is a definite factor in increasing infant mortality. So it is really associated with vascularity. Also probably poor oxygenation, but it's probably more vascularity. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I'm sorry.
Senator Bradford.
I'm not trying to defend smoking. I'm trying to say that, let's take me for instance. I got too much bad cholesterol. And my doctor now has come up with a pill I'm taking, and I have dropped that tremendously. And what I'm trying to say is, in this day and age, I'm surprised we haven't come up with something that would increase circulation to counteract the fact you're smoking, to also those people who are, how shall we say, addicted to cigarettes and just can't? I mean, are we working in that area at all or no?
You know, Senator, I just want to keep it on the conversation. All right, it's another conversation another time, but if we can stay focused on this. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great job, Linda. But, you know, I'm just confident that it's best to lay them on their stomach than on their back.
Madam Chair, I was too 20 years ago.
Well, my...
But boy, my new grandbaby that's coming in July will not be on its stomach.
But I do have a question. I had to poke a little fun at you. Very well done. But I'm reading the back cover of your report, and I noticed the number of people that were involved in your task force, and it's... a lot of great people on there. But my question, I know you're going to get together on December 12th, and review this just before the world comes to the end. Mm-hmm. But my question is, do you have any kind of a communication or monitoring or follow-up mechanism that these various people on your task force, I assume, are going to go back to these various areas and be involved? Do you have any way to kind of stay in touch with, to encourage one another, to follow up a little bit? Do you know what I'm asking?
Madam Chair, I can tell you that today, several are listening on the internet that couldn't be here. And we have task force members in the audience. Would you stand, please? Thank you. And they're in at 100% with us. I could see, you know, I get emails from task force members all the time. And so nobody's stopping. You know, just because we handed the governor the report on December 15, we're all going to work hard this whole next year. So we could give updates, too, to the Senate health committees and the House health committees, if you'd like to, throughout this year, because we're going to be doing some very exciting things. So we could sure do that, Senator.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Senator. I think that's a good suggestion. Any other questions? Seeing none. You've done some excellent work. I think you've excited a fire among the committee members, and we look forward for the successes to achieve the goals that you have laid out for the people of South Dakota for keeping our children alive and healthy.
Good. Well, thank you.
Thank you. With that, we will move on to our agenda items for our bills. First bill up is Senate Bill Number 6, which authorizes criminal background checks for various state employees. I would welcome the proponents to the table. And again, a reminder, if you're going to speak, you need to sign in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Bloomberg, Bureau of Personnel. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Bureau in regard to Senate Bill.
Thank you.
And if I could ask for a little bit of latitude, the background for this particular bill and then the following one, Senate Bill 24, grew out of the same process that we looked at. And if I could just address the process for both bills,
sure.
I'd save some time.
Before you do that, I would just ask someone to move the amendment so we can get it in the discussion.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All right. Smooth. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This summer, the governor's office and a number of state agencies were involved in a work group that looked at the question of
Before you do that, are there any questions of Mr. Bloomberg? Yes, I'm sorry, Senator. Senator Bradford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of wondered if do the people know what a disqualifying record could be?
You know, I think I'd leave that up to each of the answer that question, because again, it does vary from one agency to another. You know, an example might be if an individual perhaps had some driving violations, but they were going to be applying for a job that essentially had no driving involved, that might not be a disqualifying situation. On the other hand, if it was a job where there was going to be some driving, and they had problems with driving a motor vehicle properly, that could be disqualified. So it really depends on the particular job they're doing. And I think it also depends upon the time frame. It's one thing when you've had a criminal violation, say, in the last year, versus 20 years ago, maybe when you were in college. And each agency would look at those situations independently and make judgments based upon the particular job.
Follow-up?
Yes. Well, I guess my point is that if the person knows, most know what the record is, you know. But if they knew ahead of time that if you have a DUI on your record somewhere, that you're not going to be, that's going to disqualify you, you wouldn't even apply. I mean, that's kind of, I guess, my point. It's because sometimes, rather than be embarrassed by being disqualified, and I speak in the fact that I had a gal who was a teacher's aide, had a felony in Oklahoma 17 years back, and she'd already been working 10 years for the district. They found that and kicked her out, and she didn't know they were going to do that, or otherwise she'd have left without the embarrassment of that. So I just wondered if the person knows when he applies what could be a disqualifying record.
Senator Rappelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, you know, you're from the Department of Personnel. You know, right now, it seems like this whole thing of drugs is starting to gain some traction. And I'm sitting here, I think, well, maybe if somebody smokes, they shouldn't be hired. I'm kidding a little bit. Drink coffee, maybe. Anyway, what I was cutting at here, I noticed you are working on some sort of a criminal background, and personally, I think it's a good idea. I know I can name a few people and hire some people that had they known, you know, and I think that we become much more capable of doing this because of technology in today's world, which is good. But I'm just wondering, have you in your department considered some sort of a checking on potential drug users?
Thank you. I'm just going to follow up. You and I had a discussion yesterday, and I'm still not sound on the answer. Who currently in the departments have FBI checks?
That's a broad issue. I think Mr. Z might be able to answer that because they process all of those. But again, law enforcement, certified law enforcement, so our Highway Patrol, DCI agents, the correctional staff are included in that.
Okay, then I'll just stop you. Is there anybody that, for a background check, that quote, whatever we term background check, uses something other than an FBI or the fingerprinting?
Well, yeah, again, I think the, Madam Chair, the, for example, Human Services Center uses the EUJS.
Okay.
And I think there's some of the other agencies that use that. But again, it's limited just to South Dakota information.
I'm just going to follow through and then I'll go to you. I had also talked about when we, in the bill, it talks about the forensics, and I said, what about those individuals that handle the specimens that come back?
Yeah, and I, Madam Chair, if I could, the answer is that the, all the folks that would handle that in the chain of custody would be involved in this background testing.
Thank you. Then my other question is, you said that the potential applicant pays the fee for the test, and then in departments that they are reimbursing. Is that a policy within BOP that is, or this is a practice?
That would be the practice, and I discussed this with the potential departments, and they would employ that same practice and be reimbursing.
That's my only question, that it's not spelled in there, that it's not in your department, that's a practice, because we know that there have been occasions where departments are doing things differently, and for consistency, if we're going to do that, just to be assured, because I'm looking at a entry-level direct care provider at HSC, what their start is, and they're going to have to put out, which is, you know, the fee. And I think in the private sector, usually businesses pick up those background checks, so that's why I'm asking.
And uniformly, that policy is across the board, as I understand it. The only time where a fee might not be
And then my last question is, and I know we had talked about on those vulnerable populations, and you gave the example of business people. I'm thinking of people that work in food service or security. They have access to those vulnerable populations, and they can take them off-site or they can do whatever on-site, that they're not direct care providers. But certainly if you look at occurrences in facilities in vulnerable populations, it's not necessarily the direct care provider, it's someone in the ancillary. So that's my other concern with this.
Yeah, and I guess I would refer that potentially to the departments. But
thank you. Senator Krause.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question regarding, I was wondering if there was any state oversight of private agencies that provide, for example, home health and adult services, or is that all handled within the private agencies?
Well,
any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Bloomberg.
Thank you.
Other proponents? No other proponents are going to present?
Madam, I'm here from the DCI if there's any questions.
Why don't you come up, please, sir? Please identify yourself then for the listening audience. Thank you, Mr. Zabe. Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And excuse me if perhaps the other gentleman should answer this. With most bills that we hear out here, there's an instigating factor that brings an issue to light that causes the correction to be sought. Is there an instigating factor in this case that, say, like someone was hired that, or multiple people were hired that we go, oh, wow, why didn't we do a background check on them?
Excellent question. The
This all started this summer with the governor's office. I wanted to take a broad look at which agencies did do.
Senator Schleckway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How long does the background check process take? You know, with the multiple layers, you have the DCI and then FBI. How long does that take, usually?
Excellent question. Typically, we would indicate that the background will be turned around in the same week that we received at our office. As soon as the applicant would start.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was curious, when you started talking about that, I'm thinking about technology. And I'm wondering a little bit about retinal scans, potentially. You know, we have software for facial recognition. And I notice in here we're only talking about fingerprints. And I know that there have been certain cases where that hasn't been the best method either. Has DCI or perhaps the Bureau of Personnel looked at any other type of identifying factors that could be used in background checks?
As you pointed out currently, Senator, we use the fingerprint-based system. It's a universal fingerprint.
Follow on. The reason I forgot to mention this, the reason I kind of asked it, is because it almost seems to me that it would be a good idea in this amendment to put something at or other means of identification where we're just saying only fingerprints. But I guess we'll just come back in the future and fix that perhaps. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. I assume the Department of Social Services is a proponent on this. Would they please come forward? I have a question. Senator Krause raised it. She raised the question about would private entities require. I'm familiar with some contracts that are out there that require background checks. By putting this in place, will that mandate then that those contractors that are required to do background checks have to do FBI background checks, or is that not because of the waivers and what the feds say and what the state is doing? Would that at all come into play in on private entities if they had contracts that they'd have to use that as their format for background checks? Okay, because in the contracts, some of them do require that for the services that you have. And so I'm just, because, right.
In the discussions that we've had, we've really felt like it's up to the, you know, and I believe you are part of some of those discussions that we had this fall, that it's the...
Thank you. All right, so there are no other proponents. Are there any opponents to this? Any opponents? Seeing none, I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion or action, and I would remind the committee that we have an amendment first before us. Senator Krause.
I move Amendment 6JA.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Bradford.
Aye.
Holeen.
Aye.
Krebs.
Aye.
Rampelberg.
Aye.
Schleckaway.
Aye.
Kraus.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. With that, we now have Senate Bill number 6 as amended.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krause.
I move do pass Senate Bill number 6.
It's been moved by Senator Krause, do pass on Senate Bill number 6 as amended. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Holeen. Any comments on that motion? Hearing none. All those in favor of the motion to approve Senate Bill number 6 as amended signify by saying aye. Those nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Bradford.
Aye.
Holeen.
Aye.
Krebs.
Aye.
Rampelberg.
Aye.
Schleckaway.
Aye.
Krause.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye. Motion carried.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krause.
I move Senate Bill 6 to consent calendar.
I believe it can't go to consent because it's been amended. So I'll have to go to the floor. Thank you for the motion.
I withdraw the motion.
With that, we will now move to Senate Bill 24, which would require certain applicants for licensure as a health professional or a licensee who is subject of a disciplinary investigation to submit to a state and federal criminal background check. I would invite those that are speaking for the bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gloria Damgard, and I'm the Executive Secretary.
Thank you. I'm just going to ask anybody that testifies, you know, they always say your hearing goes first. The chair's hearing is going. So because we've got ends of the table and our microphone doesn't seem to pick up, you're going to have to speak a little louder for anybody that comes. Okay. Thank you.
Well, Senate Bill 24 is an act to require certain applicants for licensure as a health professional or a licensee who's the subject of a disciplinary investigation to submit to a state and federal criminal background check. And I think you heard the testimony for Senate Bill 6 outlines the process of what we have to do to get the criminal background record from the FBI. And currently it's the boards of medical and osteopathic examiners, the dentistry board, the nursing board, pharmacy, and nursing facility administrators that are seeking this authority to require the criminal background checks. And some of the healthcare professionals that would be regulated by these boards include physicians, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, dentists, pharmacists, and nursing facility administrators. And through the task force that Mr. Bloomberg described for you, these professions have been determined to be ones that deal with vulnerable populations, and they also have prescriptive authority, which also makes it more of a concern. And as a licensing board, our role is and responsibility is to exclude those people from licensure who pose a risk to the public, and checking whether they have a criminal history is part of that process for vetting these professionals. Currently, the boards rely on a system of self-disclosure, So really, you're just taking the word of the applicant that they don't have a criminal background. So it's not the best means of protecting the public. So that's why we're wanting to move forward with the criminal background checks that are both state and federal in nature. Now, the Board of Nursing has been doing criminal background checks on the licensees that we solely regulate since 2006, so we have some experience with that. But nurse practitioners and nurse midwives are jointly regulated by the Board of Medicine and the Board of Nursing, so they weren't included in that bill back in 2006, and so now we're seeking authority to be able to do the criminal background checks on those healthcare professionals as well. So based on past licensing history, we've determined that there's almost, it would be about 500 criminal background checks per year for all of these healthcare professionals. And I think that you understand that federal law allows the FBI to share these criminal background records with us. If we have a state statute that is approved by the United States Attorney General, and it has to contain certain elements. So all of those elements are in this bill. And with that, I would be willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Stamgard. Are there questions? I have a question. You're not, what are you doing for background checks on nurses right now?
We are doing state and federal fingerprint-based.
Okay. So this would just be consistent with what the practice is out there. No questions? Thank you. Are there other proponents? Any other proponents? Seeing none, are there opponents? Oh, okay. Thank you. See, I'm quick, so you got to be quick.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Dayock. I'm the executive director of the South Dakota Healthcare Association. We simply think this bill is a good policy.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dean Krogman, I represent the South Dakota State Medical Association, and we are in favor of the bill. Most referenced in the medical community on the need for something like this is, if some of you remember, the Dr. Slango incident. And so we are in favor of this, and I'm not sure about the fees. I think in the my understanding is that the applicant will be paying the fees for the initial check. So we appreciate your support.
Thank you. Any other proponents? I'll even give you time. Proponents? Seeing none. Are there opponents? Any opponents? Seeing none, I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for committee discussion and or action.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krause.
I move due pass Senate Bill number 24.
Senator Krause has moved due pass on Senate Bill number 24. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Schleckaway. Any comments on that motion? Hearing none, the motion before this committee is due pass on Senate Bill number 24. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Bradford. Holine.
Aye.
Oh.
Aye.
Krebs.
Aye.
Rampelberg.
Aye.
Schleckaway.
Aye.
Krause.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krause.
I'll try again. I move Senate Bill number 24 to the consent calendar.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded by Senator Krause for consent.
No.
Well, first, all those in favor for consent? Those opposed?
Aye.
Nay. Okay.
Nay.
Okay. Motion denied. Sorry. We'll go to the floor.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
This bill will be discussed.
All right.
Well, I want to thank everyone. This will probably be the biggest attendance we have. It's nice to know that the people are living in broad crowd.
I will take a personal privilege here. You have heard from Dr. Milroy. She is a general surgeon in the Yankton community, and we're very fortunate that her husband is also a medical physician. He is an orthopedic surgeon in Yankton, and their daughter was an intern here a couple years ago, so the family's very involved. So welcome, Dr. Milroy. With that, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Moved by Senator Sleckowitz.